We're spending the hour learning about our beautiful natural asset, the thousands of lakes that dot Wisconsin. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author Ted Ralsei helps us appreciate the different seasons on the lake. And the last time we checked in with him, winter was beginning to set in. In his words, a lake is seldom more beautiful than when covered with its first skin of ice. Most notably, though, in late November, there was no sign of a pandemic looming on the horizon. Do you take your family out on the lakes in the summer or any season? What are your traditions? What's important to you about interacting with our freshwater bodies? We're at 800-642-1234. Ted Ralsei writes the column The Lake Where You Live and is active in lake advocacy organizations. He's the author of A Lakeside Companion, published by UW Press. Ted, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Okay, thanks for having me back.
Well, how are you holding up in these days of COVID?
Well, it's not hard to socially distance when you live up here up north on a lake. So I guess my wife and I are doing okay. We see our daughter and son-in-law and grandkids, and hope our son and girlfriend will come up and visit us. They're sort of keeping themselves in a bubble the way that we are. So I guess everything is fine in spite of it all.
How is your Birch Lake doing? When you look out the window, what do you see?
Well, we see just a beautiful scene, filtered view through the trees. We haven't cut the trees on our shoreline. We've left everything natural. So we see a very nice green and blue panorama every day. And the lake in summer is what I would call an abundance of life.
Mm. When you go out on the lake, I assume you're out quite a bit. How are the fish doing? What are you seeing out on the lake?
Well, the fishing has been okay. It's, I would say, not great, but I get out there in the evenings for an hour or two usually, seeing lots of interesting things. Saw an otter the other day. Just yesterday, I saw an amazing thing, something I'd never seen before. Two enormous snapping turtles doing a mating dance. It was interesting because these enormous, menacing-looking creatures were just doing this graceful waltz in the water. I took a picture, and the turtle that ended up, they were face to face, and the one whose face I could see in the picture seemed like it had a smile on its face.
So, oh my goodness! Where did you see them on the lake?
Oh, it was along the shoreline. We have some state land that borders the lake, and it was off that shoreline.
Oh, wow. I bet that was really neat. What are you catching these days?
Well, mostly perch, bluegills, and walleyes, a few smallmouth bass mixed in. It's been a little slower than in a lot of recent years, but that's okay. It's just nice being out on the water.
You know, we were talking to the DNR head yesterday, and this year fishing licenses are way, way up compared to last year. Do you notice more anglers out there on Birch Lake?
Not so much on Birch Lake, but on other lakes that I visit around the area, I've seen, I guess, more traffic. There's one little tiny lake that I like to fish where generally not many people are there, but I've gone by and seen three or four trailers there at a time, which is kind of disconcerting for me.
What lake is that?
That's a secret. A fisherman has to keep a few things under wraps.
Oh my goodness, Ted Ralsei! I thought we had something. you know, you have traditions of walking around your lake, and I'm wondering what it's like in the summer to do those hikes.
Well, I can't hike around the lake in summer because my winter walks around the lake are on the ice. I can't walk around the lake in summer because everything's private property. There's no trails. But I do take occasionally a canoe ride around the lake and check out what's going on in the shallow water. Generally, I do that in spring. Didn't get to do it this year. But it's just a nice, peaceful way to kind of take the measure of the lake as we move into the summer.
We're talking with nature writer Ted Ralsei, our guide to Wisconsin lakes in the summer. He's the author of A Lakeside Companion, and you can share your stories about fishing, boating, simply exploring our lakes. We're at 800-642-1234. So, Ted, I want to rewind here back to spring for a moment. Tell us about what happens in our lakes after the ice melts and as we edge closer to summer.
Well, the most interesting thing that goes on is there's sort of a parade of different species of fish coming in to spawn and create their new broods for the year, that what the fisheries biologists call the new year class. The northern pike tend to spawn very, very early, sometimes even under the ice in the marshy areas. Muskies come somewhat after that. Perch are also early spawners. Then right after ice out, we see a few days after ice out, in come the walleyes into the shallows, and they spawn over the rocky, gravelly areas. And the largemouth and smallmouth bass after that, the crappies, the bluegills. So there are two kinds of spawners. Steve Avila-Lamont is a former DNR fisheries biologist, and he told me there's two kinds of spawners, nesters and broadcasters. And the broadcasters are the ones that basically spread their eggs over the bottom, certain kinds of bottom that they like. The perch will drape their strings of eggs over branches and plants. And then there are the nesters, like the bass, the bluegills, the crappies. They actually build nests where they lay their eggs. And the males actually make the spawning beds, and then after the eggs are laid, they protect the nest. So I like to say that's a male that everybody could love, every woman could love, who makes the bed and takes care of the kids.
All right. Well, how does the lake's temperature change as spring turns into summer?
Well, the water temperature goes up, but not uniformly. At the surface, the water begins to warm, and the cold water down below stays cold. And so in the summer, as we go into summertime, we have this layer of warm water floating on a denser layer of cold water, and that more or less persists through the summer. And there's a transition zone between the warm and the cold layers that's called the thermocline. So the lake is actually temperature stratified through the summer.
When the lake warms and during the height of the summer, what does that do to the ecosystem and the fish?
Well, it's fine. The cold layer down below is there's not very much life down there. It becomes low in oxygen and remains very cold. And on the surface, as I said, it's life in abundance. A lot of sun energy coming in, feeding the algae, which feed the tiny organisms, the zooplankton, which create the food for the little baby fish. And the food chain proceeds from there. It's a very healthy situation.
Have you seen lake level rise or fall?
On our lake, we are on what's called a drainage lake, which means we have a creek coming in and a creek going out. So in the 30-some years that I've been on this lake, either as a tourist or as a full-time resident, the water level has fluctuated no more than 6 or 8 inches, I would say. The other lakes around here, I'd say the water levels are very high. We've had some very wet years, and the lakes that don't have that automatic regulating mechanism of a creek going in and an outlet, those water levels tend to be high.
We're talking with Ted Ralsey, editor and publisher of several books on the Great Lakes region. He writes the column, The Lake Where You Live, and active in lake advocacy groups. What is your relationship to the lake near you, or what is the one you visited as a child and have fond memories of? Do you live near one of the Great Lakes? How does that impact the character of your community? Do you ever wonder about what's going on under the water? Join in with your questions, your reflections, all things lakes. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Ted Ralsey here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're exploring our lakes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're talking with our lake guy, Ted Ralsey, about lake ecosystems, why these environments are beautiful, fragile, and more active than we realize. Birch Lake in Oneida County is where Ted calls home. He finds his inspiration there, treads lightly as possible to help sustain it. Tell us about the lake you live on or those near you. What do you notice during the summer months and amid COVID? Do you have questions about how to be a steward of your lake? What can you do to take care of the waters? Join in 800-642-1234. And Ted Rulsey is our guide. So, Ted, you study inland lakes, and I understand you're working on another book addressing lake stresses. What are some of the biggest stressors on our lakes?
Well, I guess I'd like to say the biggest stress is that we are. A lot of the things that we see going on in the water, the nutrient accumulation, the invasive species, are really symptoms of what we do as lake residents and as lake visitors. Water quality begins on the land, and what we do with our lake properties can have a major impact on what goes on in the water. So if we're not keeping our shorelines natural, if we're using lots of fertilizer and pesticides, if we're not taking care of our septic systems, all of that has impacts down in the water. It affects the quality of the water itself, the fish life, the plant life. And so we need to think when we develop our properties and live on our properties about how that's affecting the water that we all share.
What you put on your lawn, or if you're trying to keep a lawn, all of that washes into the water and the shoreline.
Well, it can. One way to prevent that, it's possible to have a lawn. We prefer not to, but some people do want that. It's possible to have a lawn and still protect the lake by having a buffer strip of natural vegetation in the first, let's say, 20, 30, 40 feet up from the water. That natural vegetation will catch the runoff that comes from the lawn and absorb the nutrients so that they don't go into the lake and feed the weed growth and the algae, which can grow to nuisance proportions.
Let's talk more about the invasive species. What invasives are you seeing on Birch Lake and neighboring lakes?
Well, on Birch Lake, we see, we have rusty crayfish. We have for years. They're a voracious type of crayfish that crowds out the native crayfish, and they will reproduce spectacularly. When the crayfish first came in to this lake maybe 20, 25 years ago, you could shine a flashlight down into the water off your pier at night, and it would almost give you the creeps. There were so many of them. Another common invasive species, we don't have it, but a lot of lakes in the area do, is Eurasian water milfoil, and that grows into dense mats that can really impede boating and the use of the lake. And it's, once it's in there, it's prolific and very, very difficult to get out.
And is that transported lake to lake on boat motors?
That is the major way that it spreads, not just on boat motors, but on boat trailers. If you don't clean your boat when you leave the landing at a lake, you can transport this exotic species to another lake, and a little tiny fragment of Eurasian water milfoil can actually grow into plants and start infesting a lake. There's one lake near here where just last year Eurasian water milfoil was discovered for the first time, and predictably enough, where it was discovered was near the boat landing. So we have laws in Wisconsin against transporting weeds from one lake to another, or transporting any exotic species from one lake to another. We have the volunteer effort called Clean Boats, Clean Waters that does a good job of helping educate people about this law. So it's something we really need to pay attention to.
How do you reduce the population of the fish, the rusty crayfish?
Well, generally, There's two ways, and one is trapping, which our lake group, Friends of Birch Lake, does. Plant traps around the lake during the summer and empty them every couple of days. But the main way that the crayfish come under control is through fish predation. The fish figure out, rusty crayfish look very menacing. They'll stand up and raise their outsized pinchers, and initially that's very off-putting to the predator fish species, but the fish do figure out that they're good food and start to eat them, and that is the main thing that brings the population under control. The perch and the bluegills will eat the tiny little baby crayfish, and the walleyes and the smallmouth bass will eat the larger ones. And generally, I would say that in Birch Lake, it's come to equilibrium, except I would even say that the population last year just crashed dramatically. And I would say, I can't prove it, but I think that has hindered the quality of the fishing a little bit because it's taken a major food source out of the lake. Now, this year, the crayfish seem to be coming back.
That food system, certainly ecosystem, very delicate. Talking with Ted Rolsey, writes the column The Lake Where You Live, author of A Lakeside Companion. You can join in. Do you frequent one of our lakes in the summer? Tell us about your experience, your attachment to a particular lake. Do you ever wonder what's going on under the surface? What questions do you have about the fish, the plant life, the wildlife, the invasives? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ted, can you tell us about blue-green algae and the stress from blue-green algae?
Well, blue-green algae is nasty stuff. It can develop into nuisance proportions in lakes where the phosphorus content gets high. Phosphorus is the primary nutrient of concern in our lakes, and if we allow phosphorus to get into the lake from our septic systems, from our fertilizer, just from runoff off the land carrying soil into the lake, the algae has tons of food to feed on. It's been said that 1 pound of phosphorus in the lake can contribute to an additional 500 pounds of algae growth.
Wow.
And blue-green algae is not only unsightly when it blooms and forms a film on the water, it is also toxic. And when you have a blue-green algae bloom on the lake, you don't want your kids swimming in the water. You don't want your dog swimming in the water. I've been told stories by veterinarians that when a dog gets exposed to blue-green algae and gets sick, you might not even make it to the veterinarian in time. So it's not a good thing.
Very toxic. Does it spread very quickly?
Yes, it can. It can kind of appear overnight. It develops under the water, and then in the morning you can find the lake covered by this film. I mean, not the entire lake, maybe, but it can come on fairly suddenly, and it will gradually dissipate with time. But it can all of a sudden you wake up in the morning and you have a bloom.
You've mentioned that a concern for lake associations in our state is wake boats. What is the impact of wake boats?
Yeah, wake boats are designed to make the biggest wake possible as they go through the water. They have ballast tanks that take on water, so they ride kind of low in the water and they're heavy, and as they motor along, they make a big wake, and behind them there's a person on a wakeboard or actually wake surfing behind the boat, and that is undeniably fun. I think I probably would have enjoyed something like that as a kid, but the problem is that these wakes, if the boaters aren't behaving responsibly, can be quite destructive. There's a friend of mine lives on a lake, and he's told me that the shoreline, it almost looks as if people have been putting rocks along their shoreline, but what's really happening is that the wake boats have caused so much erosion that the rocks are exposed.
Oh, wow. That can make quite a difference.
Yeah, and these boat wakes have been known to capsize canoes and kayaks or break the pier lines that hold boats to the piers or wash pier boards off of piers. And so it's something that, you know, maybe these wake boats don't belong on lakes of certain sizes, or at least they've got to be operated significant distance from shore and otherwise responsibly. But there's a lot of consternation in the lake community about them.
Well, let's take a call now. Barb is joining us from Wabino. Hi, Barb.
I think you just answered my question. We, on our lake in Wabino, we've gotten about 8 inches of rain in the last 10 days. And I'm really concerned about the people that are speeding around the lake and my shoreline. And what is the best way for someone on the lake to handle a situation like that where the boaters have their rights and we have our rights? Where should I go to help preserve my lake?
Well, Barb, I'm not sure I understand your question completely about where to go. Are you actually asking how to protect your shoreline against erosion?
Well, I got that, but our association just changed the boating hours to increase skiing, and then we got the 8 inches of rain, and a lot of piers are underwater, and I want to be a good lake neighbor, but I also don't want my lake to erode.
Yeah, there are natural ways to protect your shoreline against erosion, if that's a thing that you're concerned about. There's really not a whole lot that can be done about the lake water level, unless you if you have an outlet to your lake, that will probably carry the water away eventually. But
and Ted, let's pause there with Barb's question. We'll get back to it in just a moment here with Lake columnist Ted Ralsei, our guide this hour. All questions, insights are welcome about our lakes and their fragile and beautiful ecosystems. Join in 800-642-1234. We'll talk more about our lakes with Ted Ralsei after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're exchanging lake stories here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As a kid, I grew up spending many a summer weekend in a rusty cabin with a potbelly stove overlooking Lake Superior near Two Harbors. I felt so small on those jagged rocks with that icy water crashing over them. And I remember the flashing beam of the Two Harbors Lighthouse. It would illuminate the waves at night, and then I kept binoculars close in the day to watch the ships. And I look at the pictures of cabin number one online now, and I hardly recognize it, all modern and well-appointed, but the bones are still there. I've wanted to return. I don't know if I'm ready, though, with my parents gone. What stories can you share about a lake that's meaningful to you? Join in 800-642-1234. Author and columnist Ted Ralsei is here with us. So, Ted, getting back to Barb and Wabino, how to help advocate for her lake, how do you protect a lake that is seeing the spike in recreation amid higher lake levels?
Yeah, and that's interesting. As during the break there, I was remembering just a few, about a week ago, I went with my son-in-law and two grandsons to a little lake in Sheboygan County, and noticed that the lake level had gone up. There were power boats racing back and forth. We came back to the lake the next day, and the Lake Association had posted a slow no wake sign. So the way that they were dealing with the high water levels and the potential damage from boat traffic under those conditions is to basically shut the power boating down, slow no wake. The lake was just as quiet as could be. There was no power boats anymore, and that's one way to protect the shoreline. If the water level has gone up temporarily, if the association got together and said, all right, we're just going to curtail the boat traffic and curtail the damage. So that's one way to do it.
Well, let's bring in Joe now in Appleton. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Ted's right. That's one way to regulate a problem on a lake is to contact your lake association, or better still, have the association form a lake district under Chapter 33 state law. The district then has more power to tax and to set regulation. Now, most people think that I have a boat, I can do whatever I want with it. Well, we can't ban boats, types of boats, horsepower, but we can regulate behavior. So if you bring in a wake boat and you do irresponsible things that damage the lake, we can post a regulation in cooperation with the town to specify what behavior is appropriate for that lake. It's like bringing a 40-foot yacht into a small lake. What can you do with the yacht? Well, we can't ban the yacht, but we can tell you you can't use it because it's going to wreck the shoreline. So most people have to get together with their districts and be active in monitoring the invasive species, going for grants to control that, and be an activist to protect the lake.
Are you active in a lake district, Joe?
I am a commissioner in a lake district, have been for 35 years, and I've seen an evolution in lake behavior to the point where you just kind of tear your hair out and wonder, how long will my lake last? And today, you have to get on board with state government and other agencies to get the grants and to get the action going to preserve the lake. Yeah, otherwise, you're going to lose your lake if you don't do anything at all. There's just too many invasive species coming. There's mussels, the rusty crayfish, and in all areas it differs, and you have to monitor that.
How has your district approached invasives?
We have gotten grants to provide chemical treatment to the lake that doesn't harm the fish. We had curly leaf pondweed for a while, and we were able to control that. Well, that morphed into another hybrid type weed that we can't control. Eurasian water milfoil was controllable by hand pulling, but then it went into a hybrid EWM. And there are very expensive chemicals. For us, it would cost us almost $300,000 for this new chemical to control that. Well, we've been paying $35,000 a year for 210 property owners to be able to treat the lake with chemicals to control those AIS, or invasive species.
Joe, thank you for bringing this. Ted, how important is it to find and band together with an association or part of an advocacy group?
Well, I'd say lake associations are really the first and best line of defense that a lake has. If you can get a lake association with a majority of the members on the lake involved and everybody pretty much on the same page, you can do a lot of good through volunteer efforts, through state grants. As Joe has mentioned, there are a variety of state grant programs that can be deployed to help protect the lakes. An active lake association is vital. Lake districts can be a very good thing to do because, as Joe said, they have more ability to set and enforce regulations. They also have the ability to tax, to make sure that the cost of taking care of the lake is shared among all property owners.
I would imagine, too, an active lake association means you know your neighbor.
That's a great thing. You know, on our lake, we don't have a lake association. We have Friends of Birch Lake, and we get together for an annual meeting and a picnic, and it does draw the people close together, and that's always helpful.
It's certainly helpful, too, to try to band together to solve problems and get, you know, kind of work together to address the challenges that a lake faces.
Right, and that's really it's really the only way is to get everybody involved. There are associations, so I hear some laments from associations sometimes. Well, we only have 30% or 50% of our lake property owners are members of our association, and that's a sad thing. Sometimes the association politics get in the way, and people get turned off, or some people say, well, I only come up to the lake on the weekends and I just want to have fun and I don't have time for lake politics. And those are things that have to be overcome. I kind of advocate a person-to-person-to-person approach, front porch to deck to pier, just getting together, talking to your neighbors and getting them involved in the association. I think the person-to-person approach is about the only one that works for recruiting a solid base of lake association membership.
I wonder, what are communication lines between lake associations and the DNR?
Well, there's the main advocacy group for lake associations is the Wisconsin Lakes. It used to be called the Wisconsin Association of Lakes, and now it's Wisconsin Lakes, and they do a wonderful job of being a conduit for information and an advocate for lake issues with the state legislature, the policymakers. So I would encourage anyone who cares about lakes to get to know Wisconsin Lakes. Go visit them online, and they have they're a wealth of information. So is the UW Extension. UW Extension has a wonderful lake specialist organization and a website that's a treasure trove of information.
Do you see differences because you are on other lakes around Wisconsin and, you know, in the Michigan's UP? Do you see a difference in how lakes are managed and cared for?
I guess I don't see the interior workings of that. There are lakes that are, even in the Northwoods here, there are lakes that are very heavily developed and there are lakes that are fairly pristine. I see a variety of lake associations, different levels of activity. A good friend of mine just recently was the driving force behind forming a lake district on his lake to take care of the Eurasian water milfoil. That effort's been really successful. So it runs the gamut.
Yeah. Talking with Ted Ralsey, editor and publisher of several books on the Great Lakes region. We're exploring our lakes and the precious resources they offer with your stories and questions about lakes at 800-642-1234. Ted, how does a lake go from being a no motorboat type lake and, keeping those boats off of a lake? What is the status for a lake to be able to have that?
I believe that lakes in Wisconsin, I'm not certain about this, but I believe that lakes smaller than 50 acres are generally considered no-wake lakes. I mean, you can have a motorboat, but you have to operate it at no-wake speed. There are some lakes that have restricted boats to electric motors only. But as what Joe said was true a minute ago. It's pretty much you can't have a motorboat on this lake. You can't have a motor larger than this horsepower. What you can do is regulate behavior. And one of the most effective ways to regulate behavior is very simple. And there's always going to be conflicts between people who like the motorized lake activities and those who like the quieter activities like canoeing, kayaking, and fishing. And the best way to strike that balance is to have hours when water skiing and motorized activities are allowed, and then quiet hours, usually in the morning and the evening, when they're not.
There's a lake that you've frequented in Michigan's UP since you were 8 years old, Duck Lake. What do you love about Duck Lake?
Well, mainly I love the connection to my childhood. I still fish in the same fishing spots that I used to when I was little and growing up with my family and exploring the lake. It's also a pretty wild lake. It's got, it's developing. There's some enormous houses on it now where they have lawns all the way down to the lake. I don't especially enjoy seeing that, but it's still pretty quiet, and fishing is very good. I just enjoy going there once or twice a year. It's a trip back in time, and really appreciate it.
Do you go in the summer months?
Generally, yeah, summer, June, July, August, sometimes in September.
We are checking in with lake columnist Ted Ralsey as we gaze out upon our favorite lakes, cool off in the height of summer. What curiosities do you have about our lakes? Are you concerned about invasives? Do you have a Wisconsin lake that's your favorite and changing? Tell us about it. Share your fishing, boating, swimming stories with us, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute. More with Ted Ralsey. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with Ted Ralsey. He calls Birch Lake home in Oneida County, writes the column The Lake Where You Live, and he stays with us. Let's take another call now. Mary is with us in Viola. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Mary, yes. My question is, I live on an organic farm in Richland County near Viola. And we had a time frame where they did not issue, or where burning permits were not issued to people when it was so dry. But my question is, people who are visiting the north and staying in cabins on lakes, last summer I had the opportunity to be with some friends on a lake up that way. And the son-in-law, who is a firefighter, at the end of our time frame, took literally all the garbage and just burned it. And it was awful. There was plastic and everything, all the food. And I thought the smell was terrible. And I just wonder how, you know, on the lakes areas in those counties that have these beautiful lakes, how they are dealing with people who are bringing in all their food and their, you know, everything that they want to enjoy, and then leaving it behind one way or the other, burning it or taking it to landfills or whatever, you know.
Yeah, that, Mary, let's, yeah, thank you. Let's get Ted to respond.
Yeah, I don't see, I don't observe things like that. I see people burning leaves or brush sometimes, and you know that activity gets curtailed when it's dry. The Forest Service posts fire danger warnings, and I don't observe littering up here. I suppose some of it goes on, but one of the things that I've observed about my lake, I can ride my bike along the roadside up here and see a bottle or a can almost every 50 feet, but when I go snorkeling in the lake, I see no litter on the lake bottom. I mean none. Over 30 years, I could probably count on one hand the times I've seen one piece of litter. So I guess I just don't see. I think people, for the most part, are quite responsible in how they handle their refuse and what they do and don't burn. I guess I just don't see the issue that the caller mentioned.
Mary, thank you for that. Ted, you know, lakes do fill up with water weeds during the summer. Why are these weeds so important to the lake ecosystem?
Well, they're tremendously important. I even wish sometimes we wouldn't call them weeds, because weeds, almost by definition, are things growing where we don't want them. The term weed has a negative connotation, not so much with lakes, I guess, but they're a source of cover for wildlife and fish. They're a source of food. They provide cooling shade. They provide oxygen to the water through photosynthesis. They're great for fishermen to know. That's where the fish hang out. Some of the best fishing is in the weeds. The weeds also protect the shoreline to some degree against erosion from wave action. They provide a buffer against that. So they're extremely valuable.
What happens as the summer days come to an end and the cooler weather of September sets in?
Yeah, we're kind of starting down that slide right now. It's gotten a little colder, or cooler, I would say, the last few days. And the water temperature on our lake has dropped about, the surface temperature anyway, has dropped about 10 degrees since we had the heat wave a couple of weeks ago, after the cool days and nights that we've had recently. But gradually the water is cooling, and that surface water is cooling, and pretty soon the water temperature of the lake is uniform. We don't have that thermal stratification anymore, and the lake, when comes September, mid-September or late September, is going to get a thorough stirring and mixing from the wind and wave action, and start us toward the winter and the formation of the ice.
Do you take water samples or check the lake's temperature pretty frequently?
Well, I check the temperature by way of the fish locator on my boat. It reads out the surface temperature, but I am the Citizens Lake Monitoring Network volunteer for our lake, so I take what are called Secchi disc readings, and that is an instrument that's a black and white plate like thing that you drop into the water on a rope, and you measure how far down you can still see the Secchi disc. And that's a reading of the water clarity, and I report that to the Lake Monitoring Network at the end of each year. So I get to see how the lake water clarity changes from spring and all the way into fall.
Does that stay pretty consistent?
Oh, no, it changes a lot. In springtime, I think the Secchi disc reading we had, the earliest one this spring, was 18 feet, which means you can see the Secchi disc 18 feet down below the surface of the water. As we get into August and September, as the algae accumulates in the lake, even if we don't have a bloom, there's algae accumulation, and we might see a Secchi disc reading of as little as 6 feet.
So, oh, wow, yeah.
And after the algae dies off in September into October, we'd be seeing those much more clearer water again.
Well, Ted, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
Ted Relsey writes the Lake Where You Live column, author of A Lakeside Companion. In the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, tests for COVID-19 were in short supply. Wisconsin has built up its testing capacity since then, but experts say it's not enough to get the pandemic under control. Bram Sable-Smith looks at where we are with our testing and where we may be heading.
UW epidemiologist Ajay Sethi says there's a straightforward reason to get a COVID-19 test.
The only way you will know whether or not that you have COVID is to get a test.
Sethi says in public health, testing is what's known as a secondary prevention strategy, meaning something that lets you detect a problem early. The gold standard in public health is primary prevention, or stopping something before it can happen. And Sethi says testing can be used to help do that too.
If we could test everybody in a community in a week, single day, then we could see who has a disease, who doesn't, and appropriately isolate those people who have disease.
But of course, we can't test everyone in Wisconsin all at once. The state's current daily capacity for tests is about 24,000. And the number of tests actually reported each day is about half of that, meaning too few people are showing up. Even Wisconsin's single-day record of over 16,000 tests is well below the number needed to keep the outbreak from growing. A Harvard analysis from the end of June said that would take 19,000 tests a day, and 70,000 daily tests are needed to actually suppress the outbreak. Chuck Wierzeka of the Wisconsin Health Department says that while having a target number of tests is helpful,
the number itself is really a surrogate for the right testing that we're trying to achieve.
Essentially, Wierzeka says it's not the number of tests exactly, it's how you use them. That means testing people with symptoms and their close contacts, but also paying special attention to high-risk populations and communities with active outbreaks. That includes testing asymptomatic people at nursing homes, where DHS has investigated 151 outbreaks. And Wierzeka says the state is still focused on increasing its daily testing capacity. But
we're always watching the national supply chain because it's still kind of teetering on the edge of running out of different important materials.
Important materials like the swabs that go in your nose and the chemicals needed to even run the tests. In other states like California, Georgia, and Florida, supply shortages have forced officials to turn some test seekers away or even shutter some testing sites. Ezekiel Emanuel of the University of Pennsylvania says the federal government would typically help shore up that supply chain. But that hasn't happened, as President Trump's administration has played a largely hands-off role in responding to the pandemic.
We should have been spending the last 4 months beefing up the supply chain, making sure we had enough machines, inducing the large test companies to actually put in the capacity and make the capital investment.
Instead, individual states like Wisconsin are on their own to procure the supplies and also to develop their own testing strategies. Emanuel says that's not typical.
In another moment, not a Trump administration moment, you would have had good guidance from the federal government about things like who to test, what sequence.
Wierzeka says Wisconsin is getting some guidance on testing from the federal government, but they're also collaborating with other state and local health agencies. This virus is new and novel for all of them.
We're learning probably as much from other states and from our local health departments as we are from at the federal level, and we're doing our best to share up the learning that we're doing as well.
And Wierzeka says testing alone won't stop the outbreak.
If people are opening up too quickly, And people aren't wearing masks when they're in public and they're spending too much time in congregate settings, it really isn't going to be enough testing to help you stop the outbreak.
That means people's behavior matters too. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And that story comes from a partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.